From the Sky News Centre at 6, the Chancellor George Osborne has defended Boris Johnson over comments he made about British jihadists. The London Mayor says men who leave the UK to join Islamic State militants feel like losers who have no luck with women. Some Muslim groups have branded the comments irresponsible, but his Conservative colleague Mr Osborne denies the remarks were wrong.
Well, Boris always uses very colourful language, but he's right that these people don't wish us well and we shouldn't have kind words for them.
Police in Dorset searching for the mother of four, Samantha Henderson, have found a body in a lake. The 25-year-old hasn't been seen for more than a week. Her boyfriend's been charged with her murder. A GP has been jailed for 12 years for sexually abusing two teenage girls. 61-year-old Dr. Hugh Blaise O'Neill admitted the crimes at Norwich Crown Court. Police are investigating an alleged road rage incident involving Roy Keane. Officers responded to reports the ex-footballer got into an argument with a taxi driver in Altrincham town centre this morning. A school has defended its decision to place a pupil in isolation after he had his head shaved for charity. Nick Qureshi reports.
The 14-year-old had a number one haircut on Sunday. He wanted to raise money for Macmillan Cancer Support. Churchill Academy in North Somerset says school policy was flouted and it needs to uphold standards. Friends have since set up a free Stan Lock petition, while donations to his Just Giving page have shot up. The teenager says he's pleased with the support he's been given and he doesn't regret having his head shaved.
Now, exactly 50 years after Sir Winston Churchill's state funeral, a special ceremony has been held to remember the World War II leader. The same boat that carried his coffin retraced the journey it made along the River Thames half a century ago. And David Ginola's brief attempts to become the new FIFA president are definitely over. He's failed to receive the required nominations to stand. The Frenchman tried to crowdfund his campaign via a website, which says any money pledged will be returned. And that's the latest. I'm Caroline Henry.
On your award-winning Bristol radio station.
There are two influences. One for light, under which everything grows and blossoms, and one is darkness, in which everything decays and dies. In any part of the world, within the year, the same hours of darkness and light supervene. And you have these two invisible influences striving for the soul of man. We don't know why, any more we know what is eternity.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. $75 million Native Americans died after Bristol merchants discovered America. 6 million slaves on the Middle Passage. So what are the merchant venturers up to in our schools and hospitals nowadays? A new play opens in London, Truth, Lies and Diana, and a new book is out too, Princess Diana, The Shocking Truth About Her Murder on the August 1997 assassination that refuses to go away. And as the date and venue of this year's annual Bilderberg Conference is confirmed, which is chaired for the first 20 years by a former SS officer and controls most of the arms, money and media in the Western world, we take a good hard look at Bristol's elite. Those merchant venturers, how much they're worth, we've not been told, but over the last decades they've expanded their influence, particularly to our schools and hospitals. So where exactly are they, and what are they the right people to be deciding on how our taxes are spent? And as Prince Abdullah of Saudi Arabia dies, the BBC release a brilliant 2.25-hour documentary about the US special relationship with Saudi Arabia. But it won't be shown on British television, on the iPlayer only. Adam Curtis's latest film, Bitter Lake, looks too at Afghanistan and how Saudi Arabia and the US have fueled the rise of Wahhabism and the extremist versions of Islam we see today. But we start this week, Martin, on a slightly different tack, following on from last week. In the news, today, we hear that a vicar's 9/11 Facebook post is being investigated by the church. I mean, we were speaking to the 9/11 consensus panel last week, Elizabeth Woodward, and David Ray Griffin is on that panel too. They're trying to get the debate going in the Canadian Parliament, but it seems that the church are trying to stop that discussion here. The Church of England is investigating a vicar accused of posting an article on Facebook which blames Israel for the 9/11 attacks in America.
Well, he's reposting an article that he's found on the internet. The Church of England, I presume, feel that that he's bringing their name into disrepute or whatever.
Well, immediately the reaction is that he reportedly wrote, "Is this anti-Semitic? It raises so many questions."
Well, I would argue that the article concerned is not anti-Semitic. There is strong evidence to suggest that the Israelis had some hand in 9/11. And, for example, the five dancing Israelis, people could just do a search on that, and they will find that the Bergen Record and Fox News reported that five Israelis were seen as the first plane hit the first tower, filming the tower, filming the event, and they were later arrested. And they turned out to be Mossad agents.
Well, that may be. The Israeli Secret Service had been spying better than the Americans had on the people who carried it out.
Well, Pierce Seglovitz, I believe, who was the leader of the group, was on. They were held in the US and interrogated, and he was interviewed on television in Israel, and he said, "All we were doing as Mossad agents was documenting the event." Now, don't forget, it was when the first plane hit the first tower that they were filming. In other words, they knew that plane was going to hit that tower, and they were in exactly the right place to film it. Just as, incidentally, an Israeli journalist happened to be in exactly the right place to film the Charlie Hebdo attack. He just happened to be there with his video camera. Now,
but I mean, look, the explanation here, if I was from Mossad, I'd be telling you, hang on a minute, Martin, we had some intelligence that it might happen, but it certainly doesn't imply that we planned it.
What they did at the time, apparently, is they slapped and did high fives and started burning cigarette lighters in the air. In other words, they looked pleased about it. And because they looked pleased about it, they were reported to the local police in Bergen in New York, and therefore arrested 8 hours later in the van. And when they were arrested, they were carrying plans of the World Trade Center and thousands of dollars in cash. Now, I don't know whether that shows that Israel was involved, but I think it certainly raises the question that they may have been involved. And therefore, I'm afraid if we're going to have wars on terrorism, we're going to have to get really used to talking about terrorist incidents, about timelines, about who said what to who, about what weaponry was used, etc., etc. So, for example, the finding of Charlie Hebdo, one of the Charlie Hebdo's attackers' passports in his car, just like it happened on 9/11 with Ahmed Assad's passport, not believable, as has been pointed out by the President of Turkey and the French National Front leader, Jean-Marie Le Pen.
Anyway, let's have a look and see what the Anglican Church have got to say about this vicar's 9/11 Facebook post, which is now apparently taken down, but he's certainly still defending it. He says, they say, our attention's been drawn to comments by the Reverend Stephen Sizer, S-I-Z-E-R, on social media. In those comments, the Reverend Sizer linked to an article entitled 9/11 Israel Did It. The spokesman from the Anglican Church said these comments would rightly be seen as unacceptable wherever they were posted. It's a matter of deep sorrow and shame that they've been posted in this week of all weeks. He's talking about Holocaust Memorial Week.
Well, I'm afraid that the State of Israel and Mossad have a track record of engaging in terrorist incidents, going back to the Lavon affair in the 1950s, where it's proved beyond any kind of doubt that they were bombing facilities in Egypt belonging to the British and the French and pretending to be Islamist extremists. The Israeli state also tried to sink the USS Liberty in 1967, killing scores of US servicemen. Now, these are just factual matters. I mean, a state like Israel, a security state like Israel, which has enemies around every corner, is a very, very serious about its own security, to the extent that it's prepared to break the law, to the extent that it's prepared to carry out terrorist attacks, both on its own soil and elsewhere. And I'm afraid, as we drift towards World War III, we're going to find all these kind of accusations floating around the place. The question of what's happened in the Ukraine, about who shot planes down and so on. I'm afraid that people are just going to have to get used to debating these things, because as you go to war and wars start to happen, then these debates have to be had. And it's no use accusing people of anti-Semitism. There's plenty of people who aren't Jews who are suspected of being involved in all these terrorist incidents. But that doesn't mean that we're going to shut up about it. I'm afraid that the real world that we live in now is, if people aren't prepared to have a proper debate about things, then they're just going to be disappointed. Because in the days of the internet, we're going to get to the bottom of a lot more things a lot faster than we used to do. And I'm afraid the Israeli state is going to have to take its licks along with everybody else.
Well, there was a time where actually Bilderberg conferences could creep up on one and one didn't actually know where it was going to take place. But those times are over now, as you were saying. There's quite a lot of sleuthing goes on the internet to see where the next Bilderberg conference is happening. And it's been confirmed as just a 2-hour car drive away from Hitler's birthplace in Austria, in Tyrol, which is very near Innsbruck, in Austria. And the local police have confirmed that that's where it's taking place. Now, you mentioned in the first hour of the Bilderberg conferences, Ed Balls and George Osborne both sitting down together and taking their, basically, orders from the financial elite. I mentioned at the right at the top of the hour, media being there, bankers being there, and many politicians.
Well, Fernando Imposimato is the head of the Italian Supreme Court. He's in the Italian press, has directly accused Bilderberg of being behind various terrorist incidents in Italy going back 30, 40 years, and that they're doing it through NATO's Gladio networks. Now, I'm afraid in the 21st century, as we drift into World War III, which is where we're going, and a banking collapse, I'm afraid people are going to have to start listening to an awful lot of stuff that they don't want to hear, but which is in fact absolutely legitimate political debate. I'm afraid a lot of the terrorism that's been going on over the past 30 years has been orchestrated from inside various Western intelligence services.
Well, I must admit,
and they're not the only culprits by any sense.
I must admit, this place, that the Interalpen Hotel in Tyrol, looks a little bit like the sort of Telly Savalas Bond villains kind of headquarters up in the mountains.
Mm. Well, it's interesting because the Austrians, the Slovenians, the Slovakians, the Czechs, the Hungarians, and the Greeks are those that are most sceptical about this confrontational stance with Russia. So it may be that some common sense will prevail inside the global elite when they meet in Austria, and they may decide that they're not going to have World War III.
No, don't hold your breath.
Don't hold your breath.
Yeah, don't hold your breath is exactly what I was going to say. Now, the reason that this is linked to the wars, of course, is that the Bilderberg Conference is not, they don't run the world or anything like that, but they are very, very closely linked, aren't they, to the NATO countries.
They are, and as I said, Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, has pointed the finger at the Bilderberg Group as being the prime movers behind terrorism in Italy over several decades.
So if George Osborne is there and Ed Balls is there, what kind of orders are they getting? You said things like privatisation of healthcare.
Well, I understand that those who attend Bilderberg, I mean, you can't just invite yourself, you are invited. But that there is a ground plan that they are all supposed to address, which is to do with holding together the existing financial and political structure. It wouldn't be surprising. That's the sort of thing that ruling classes do, and that's what they are doing. But as I say, the head of the Italian Supreme Court has definitely pointed the finger at Bilderberg as being the core source of terrorist atrocities over many decades.
Yes, and chaired for the first 20 years from 1954 to the mid-1970s by a former SS officer. So where does this all leave us voting? We've got a general election coming up here in May.
Well, I'm not going to go with Russell Brand and say that because all of these bad people behind the scenes are ruling the roost, that voting's a waste of time. Vote, that's what they want you to think. Voting, in fact, is very, very marginal. The real power lies elsewhere, but not voting is no solution at all. We've just seen the victory of the Syriza party in Greece.
Yes, and possibly Portugal is going to have a similar party.
Indeed, and the point is that and don't forget that the Greeks really value democracy because the Bilderberg Group and its acolytes imposed a military government on Greece in 1967, which killed a great number of Greeks, no doubt many family members of the current new government in Greece. And I'm afraid that that's the strategy of tension in Italy that was being pursued in the 60s, 70s and 80s became a military coup in Greece, an outright military coup supported by NATO. And everybody in Greece knows this. There was a military government in Greece supported by NATO. And when people say, oh, but NATO is just a way of defending ourselves and our freedoms, it's like, no, the military coup in Greece was carried out by NATO, as every Greek knows.
Well, most of what NATO's up to now seems to be to do with ISIS. And so let's have a look at that now. And many of the historical reasons that ISIS has come together were looked at in the latest Adam Curtis documentary. He's done ones in the past, The Power of Nightmares, The Century of the Self, back in the noughties. But this latest one really is, I think, one of his best so far. And we're going to hear a sort of introductory clip from it now, which brings in this whole idea of, well, actually, our politics is in a terrible mess. And Adam Curtis puts it like this.
Those in power tell stories to help us make sense of the complexity of reality. But those stories are increasingly unconvincing and hollow. This is a film about why those stories have stopped making sense, and how that led us in the West to become a dangerous and destructive force in the world.
So he's almost doing something impossible there. He's saying that the West is the problem, Martin, almost like the evil empire.
Well, it doesn't take much intelligence to recognise that the most powerful countries on the planet are definitely the ones that have the most influence for good or ill. And I'm afraid the ruling class in the West has demonstrated, to my mind, its complete unfitness to rule because of its rapacious attitude.
And
very, very much since the collapse of the Berlin Wall in 1989, a massive historic opportunity, absolutely squandered.
Yes, the peace dividend. Whatever happened to that?
Yes, what indeed?
And at the heart of the film is this relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, which has been so strong. I mean, whereabouts is that today? Still as strong as ever?
Well, it's strong as ever because they're absolutely dependent upon the Saudis continuing to price oil in dollars to preserve the petrodollar system, which keeps the Wall Street afloat.
Well, I think he's timed his documentary.
They're absolutely bound together by that.
He's timed his documentary perfectly in a way with the death of King Abdullah just two or three days beforehand. I also noticed that the BBC were announcing on Radio 4 bulletins and on Radio 5 bulletins last Friday that Abdullah had died that morning, whereas actually the fact of the matter was he died on the Thursday morning, but it was never announced to the world until all of the rituals and succession had all been sorted out and agreed, and then it was announced. So that does tell you something about the fragility of the monarchy in Saudi Arabia.
Well, indeed, and of course they don't represent anybody except the ruling clan. They certainly don't represent the Shia oil workers in the main oil fields in Saudi Arabia, for example, brutally repressed.
Okay, let's have a listen to where the documentary, Adam Curtis's documentary, Bitter Lake, gets its title from, because it's a part of the Suez Canal, which is where Roosevelt met the Saudi king in 1945 at the end of World War II.
At the end of the Second World War, President Roosevelt travelled to the Great Bitter Lake in the middle of the Suez Canal. At the same time, he sent another American warship to pick up the King of Saudi Arabia, King Abdulaziz. The meeting of King and President was to have powerful and disastrous consequences, both for the West and, in a strange way, for Afghanistan. Roosevelt was dying, but over the last 13 years, he had used his power on an epic scale to transform the world. After the Wall Street crash and the terrible depression that followed, Roosevelt had taken charge. He had passed laws that broke up the banks, so they would never run out of control again. And he had rebuilt America with a series of giant dams that brought electrical power and employment to millions of people. And he had planned and fought a world war against Germany and Japan. Now, as Roosevelt sat waiting for Abdulaziz, no one could possibly have imagined the consequences of this meeting. For it was going to unleash forces that in the future would undermine everything that Roosevelt had worked for. His belief that politicians should use their power in a planned way to reshape the world. But Roosevelt knew that to keep that power, America needed oil. And he wanted to forge an alliance with the king to make sure that the vast Saudi oil fields remain under American control. In their conversation, the two men laid the foundations for an alliance that continues to the present day. A America would get its oil, and in return, Saudi Arabia would receive wealth and security from America. But the king was well aware of the dangers of opening up his country to the influence of the modern West. And in the negotiations that followed, he laid down a condition. "We will take your technology and your money," he said, "but you must leave our faith alone." The Saudi faith was called Wahhabism. It was a radical, violent, and extremely puritanical form of Islam. And its followers among the Bedouin tribes hated the modern world. Wahhabism was part of a wider movement in Islam that had risen up in reaction to the European empires. Another was the Deobandi movement in India. They all believed that modern imperialism was corrupting the true nature of Islam and wanted to go back to a world based on the original teachings of the Islamic texts. Abdulaziz had harnessed this force in the 1920s to seize power. But he had unleashed something that didn't want to stop. The Wahhabists wanted to go on and create a caliphate across the whole of the Arab world. And to stop them, in 1929, Abdulaziz machine-gunned them. He ruthlessly killed the warriors who had made him king. But their belief, a violent, intolerant, and above all backward-looking version of Islam, remained at the heart of Saudi Arabian society. And the deal made that day on the Great Bitter Lake meant that America would get its oil, but it would also be protecting Wahhabism, a force that had its own global ambitions. Ambitions that were very different from America's.
A little clip there from Bitter Lake, which was brought out on iPlayer. Shame you're not going to see it on the television, Martin.
Well, it's strange, isn't it, if the BBC have commissioned the film, but it's only going to be shown on the internet, presumably because the Saudis wouldn't be happy, and perhaps the Americans also.
Okay, well, maybe. I think it was commissioned by BBC Online, not by the channels. That's why it's been shown online. But what about this wider picture of Wahhabism and the influence that it's had? Because a lot of the oil money that we've been paying through fuel in Britain and America and the Western world to Saudi Arabia has gone on these kind of Wahhabi training schools.
Well, yes, when the madrasas in Pakistan were where the Taliban were nursed into life by the Saudi secret services and the British and the Americans.
Okay, so where is this going? I mean, do you think Saudi Arabia is going to continue to be able to carry on with its monarchy? Because as I said before, we heard the clip there. It's actually quite a fragile monarchy. A lot of people in Saudi Arabia, including the army. I remember seeing a documentary a while ago with which was rebels basically going around within army camps, showing, well, actually, look, you know, this place is actually on the brink of revolution.
Well, it's hard to say, isn't it, unless you're an insider. The point is that Saudi Arabia is a massively reactionary place. When King Fahd died, as I said the other week, when they're having the election. And, of course, at the same time, we're lecturing President Assad of Syria about what sort of democracy he ought to have. Meanwhile, the rebels who are trying to overthrow him are being armed and trained by our own special forces and by with Saudi money. And at the same time, we're pretending to fight ISIS. It doesn't add up.
Okay. What's your thoughts then about what's going to happen with this whole battle with ISIS? There's been a big attempt, hasn't there? Most of it successful to get many of the Western countries, including places like Australia too, Canada, etc., on board with the NATO project to defeat ISIS.
Well, the real danger, of course, is that there's going to be a further war between Hezbollah and Israel. That's been developing this week. Both sides have carried out attacks on each other. And you could have a general Middle East war, that's definitely...
How would ISIS fit in there, then?
Well, ISIS would just be one of the factions, which a Middle East war would be like Yugoslavia on steroids, and ISIS would be one of the factions involved. But, of course, the Iranians are already of the view that ISIS is being supported directly and indirectly by the Western powers and by the Israelis.
Yeah, well, this idea that that the Middle East could become kind of balkanised is actually one of the first times I've ever seen it talked about was by this Israeli general Yinon.
The Yinon plan from the 1980s.
Just explain that. What's that all about?
Well, the Yinon plan in the 1980s was a sort of plan cooked up by the Israeli general staff, and it's in their interest for these countries around Israel, who they regard as a threat, to be in internal strife and with civil wars raging. And certainly fighters inside Syria have been taking rest and recreation inside Israeli-controlled Golan Heights. And then the Israelis last week killed an Iranian general and several Hezbollah leaders in a precision strike. And Hezbollah hit back yesterday by killing a couple of Israeli soldiers at the Shabar farms. And then the Israelis fired back and killed a Spanish peacekeeper. But the danger is that we're going to have a general Middle East. Well, at any point, you see, the Israelis could decide to attack Iran's nuclear reactors. And at that point, you're going to get a general war in the Middle East, which we will be dragged into. That's the whole point of British people being there with boots on the ground, is that we will be dragged into it. We won't be able to stay out of it. Maybe the Swiss will be able to stay out of it, but it won't be. We will be dragged in.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now let's move on to discuss the merchant ventures. As I said at the top of the hour, I think it's probably a good idea to put it in context where these Bristol merchants come from, because even before the merchant venturers was formed, we had a very strong merchant contingent in the city. They were involved in financing the trip to the United States, which was not sort of it was Newfoundland, and to help discover America, which was of course already been discovered by Native Americans, and then there was a massive genocide over hundreds of years after that, with 75 million Native Americans that died. Then the merchant venturers were formed. They conducted the slave trade, where between 5-6 million. Died on the Middle Passage, being taken from Africa, rounded up, treated like animals, basically put on slave ships and sent over to the Caribbean. So we had before Christmas the new master of the merchant venturers, Chris Curling, on here talking about his work. But I'm joined now by Daphne Havercroft from Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group, and Christine Townsend, who works in education. Hi, both of you, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony.
Hello, thank you.
I think we'll start with you first, Daphne. The merchants are getting a little bit more open about who their members are. They've got a website with a list of them and some of the things that they do. But can we look at it from a different point of view, just from health on its own, for example? Whereabouts, because much of the money that's spent on health, of course, is taxpayers' money, public money, but merchants are there, aren't they, helping to spend it?
Yeah, they're in a very influential position. And if we look at the two major hospital trusts in Bristol, so there's North Bristol NHS Trust, their former chair was Alfred Morris, who's a merchant. The current chair is Peter Rylett, who's a merchant. He's, if you look at education, he's also was a governor at chair of governors at Bristol Grammar. At University Hospitals Bristol NHS Foundation Trust, we've got John Savage, who's been the board chair since December 2006, and one of the leading consultants at that hospital, Dr. Jacqueline Cornish, who was the head of Women's and Children's, the division at the Bristol Children's Hospital. And she is now a consultant in bone marrow transplant, but also in a senior position at NHS England, a national director in Women's and Children's Services.
I wonder whether it's which way round it all works. Are these people merchant venturers and then go on to these boards, or do the merchant venturers look around saying, who's doing well in the city? Somebody seems to be doing quite well, we'll invite them to join.
Well, I think the merchants select the people that they want to be part of their band of merchant venturers. And if you look on their website, it gives the list of who the people are, and you can go in and find out all the things they're involved in and their background. So it is, as I understand it, membership by invitation. And that gives them a stepping stone into some very influential positions in health, in business, in education.
And one of the things I was quite shocked by was the number of charities and trusts that the merchant venturers are involved in. So let's have a little listen now to what I think is one of the definitive bits of work on this, on the merchants, which is James Garrett's documentary that he did back in 1995 for HTV.
If the merchants is about one thing, it's about charity. It's about being involved in the administration of 12 charities and 40 trusts.
That's quite a lot, isn't it? 12 charities and 40 trusts, he's saying. And that's just one person from Merchant Ventures. So Daphne, what's your impression of where the wealth comes from the merchants? It's obviously historical, and much of it is kept in trust. Much of it's given out as charitable works. But how do we get a handle on how big it is? Because one of the first things I came across was the fact that you cannot actually get the accounts from Companies House because they have a royal charter and they are exempt.
Yeah, well, it's difficult to know where the money comes from. And if you look at one of the charitable organisations that the merchants are involved in, which is St Monica's, so residential homes, retirement homes, so they administer that, they're the trustees for it. But then the question is, where does the money come from? Well, we know that some of it comes from the NHS, because acute hospitals, where they've got the problems, both the Bristol hospitals, over bed blocking and getting people into being cared for, because they have a shortage of beds because of the difficulty of discharging people. And I understand that some of them are going into homes that are run by the merchant venturers.
Now, so I can remember when I was working for Avon Fire Service years ago, the deputy fire chief over in Bath, I think he was based, he had his own little charity, which was to do with training. And then the fire service were sending all of their new recruits to his charity for training. And actually, he was making quite a bit of money out of that. And when someone wrote a comment in the fire service magazine about it, I think it was a slightly sort of jaunty, witty comment taking the mickey out of him. The chief leant over the shoulder of the woman who was editing the local fire magazine and said, "No, we're not having that in." Basically, so we're not putting that in the local in our little Avon Fire Service magazine. But there is the danger, isn't there, of that kind of thing? Christine, you work in education and you've looked quite a lot at the merchants and which schools they are now running. Maybe you could start with the ones that they've run for a long time and just tell us, whereabouts are the merchants in our city schools?
Well, the ones that they've run for a long time are some of the most kind of prestigious, I suppose you'd say, private schools. So they're involved in QEH. They founded Colston School over in French A. They founded Colston Girls School when that was a private school. They've been involved in Bristol Cathedral School for many years. And, of course, a couple of those are now state schools.
See, this is blurring the lines a bit, isn't it? We've started off with private schools, and now we've got these kind of half-private, half-state schools, which are, although it's still run as a private school, and they're quite selective about where they take the recruits, bringing new young people in there, they're now state-funded.
Yeah, Cathedral Girls School and what is now Bristol Cathedral Choir School were the first two private schools in the country to come into the state sector as academies.
Well, that's interesting,
because Bristol's
pioneered that, but is it a good thing?
Well, I would argue that it's not a good thing, because one of the things about academies that's different to being a local authority school is that the schools themselves and the people that run the schools get to write their own admissions policies. So they decide, so long as it's within the law, how they're going to allocate their places. But the people that administer that are the same people that write the policy. And that's kind of part of what I've been looking at, is just kind of, okay, well, who's writing this policy and who's administering this policy and how does this system actually work?
Okay, well, what about academies? Because I know there are sort of chains that run academies, aren't there? But one of them I was looking at the other day, which looks a little bit iffy, was something called ARC Academies. I mean, so are these basically like run like private businesses, charities? What? How does it work?
Well, they academies have charitable status. They're supposed to be, they are allowed to make money on their assets. So they are allowed to hire out their premises, and the money that is made comes in, and that becomes part of the money that is then supposed to be spent on the education of the children and to improve the kind of the education service that they're providing. So they are allowed to do that. And what I actually find very interesting is that the Bristol Cathedral Choir School still has 30 acres of playing field up in Fayland, you know, the other side of the bridge, because it always had those playing fields when it was a private school. Now, when I looked at the expression of interest, which is like the first document that the school would have filled out when it was a private school, it actually paid the city council who owns the land nothing per year to rent, to hire this land. And in 2018, the rent is due to go up to £500 a year. Now, that school can hire that playing fields out, and it does, and it, you know, that's part of kind of what it's allowed to be doing. But if it's only given our council £500 for that, for the pleasure of that, the rest of that money is supposed to be ploughed back into that school, which, you know, you may or may not have a problem with. But when we look at who that school is then serving, then it becomes an issue, because some of those places every year are going to children that don't live in the city. And hundreds of Bristol children that do live in the city get turned away.
Well, we've been sold this idea that academies are somehow going to be better than the old-fashioned schools. I noticed in The Guardian just this week, no proof that academies raise standards, finds inquiry in education. The Education Committee makes a series of recommendations to address the concerns over governance, transparency and oversight. And, of course, this links in with what you have been saying about health, Daphne, is that, what we're dealing with now is actually rather secretive organisations. It's rather difficult. And, you know, you yourself have been expelled, you know, as if you've done something wrong from school, you know, from the Central Bristol Hospital Trust.
Well, this is where foundation trusts come in, because University Hospitals Bristol is a foundation trust, which means that they have more autonomy about how they spend their profits. They don't have to send as much money back to the Department of Health. And so you've got a merchant venturer, John Savage, who is the chair of the board. The only way that the public can get to scrutinise what he and his board are doing and hold them to account is through the governors. Now, some of them are elected by staff, some of them are elected by patients and the public, if they happen to be members of the trust. But the only way these volunteer governors can actually hold the board to account on behalf of us is by managing the performance of the chair and the non-executives. Now, the chair, John Savage, chairs the governor's membership council. So you would have to have some very determined and strong governors to actually stand up to him, manage his performance and hold him to account for him.
Yes, and someone who's sat on committees with John, I think I'd agree with you that it would have to be extremely tough to stand up to him. I mean,
I've done that. I've stood up to him and I got booted as a Foundation Trust member.
But was there any actual evidence or reason given for you being told that you weren't allowed to continue
member? There was something that was circulated around the governors that I had cost £720,000 of public money through Freedom of Information activities. So I've asked them to substantiate it, and they won't.
Okay, you must have sent how many thousands of Freedom of Information requests did you send?
I can't remember, but there is no law that says that there's a limit on Freedom of Information requests that anyone can send.
So have you sent them 1,000 Freedom of Information requests?
No, not at all. I mean, Heather Brooke, who exposed the MP's expenses, I remember she did a talk in Bristol and said she was on about her 600th. So I haven't done anything approaching that. But Freedom of Information, accountability, and the NHS Code of Conduct for boards is that they have to hold themselves to account and open themselves up to public scrutiny. But when you try that, they don't want to be scrutinised. And so if you don't want to be open about what you're doing, that says to me, what are you hiding? What are you afraid of?
Okay, back to schools again. And I noticed just at the end of last year, there was some pretty shocking stuff came out about one particular academy as a head on £230,000. He made extra cash running a health club at his school. Auditors have launched a probe into the academy teacher who also employed his ex-wife as his deputy head. Sir Greg Martin enjoyed a 56% pay rise last year, earning £230,000. The head teacher he raked in cash running his health business, and his firm has been paid £500,000 in management fees out of public money over the last 3 years. And the National Audit Office is looking into it, but is unable to determine the extent of his benefits, believed to be one of the highest paid executive heads anywhere in the country. This chap, Sir Greg Martin, has also got a knighthood as an academy head. So it's obviously somebody somewhere thinks that he's good at what he's doing.
Well, obviously, it sounds like this guy's got a very nice life. Thank you very much. I mean, six-figure salaries are something that you see in academies across the country, and we certainly see them in Bristol. I don't know that anyone's being paid quite as much as £250,000. But certainly what you do see is the chair of governors also being on the trustee body. And, you know, you've got the same people running the school as you have running the sponsor. And again, I would agree with you, Daphne, that actually it's really very difficult when you start asking questions about where's the money going, how do you proceed, you know, who is it that's doing these particular
things? So, well, we've heard Daphne's experience. What's yours, Christine?
Well, my I suppose the best one that I can give here is when the Cathedral Primary School said, oh, I think we'll have your library, thank you very much, to put our primary in there. What I did was look to see who this school was going to be serving.
Oh, that's the public library, Bristol Public Library, isn't it?
Yeah, is it?
On great College Green. You
know, yeah, absolutely. And so I looked at to see who this school, who's going to get places at this school, because I understood how the secondary was operating and I knew that it would be the same people that were wanting to open the primary. And they're serving three local authority areas by this random allocation. So I was kind of like, okay, I'm interested in how and who randomly allocates these places. And so I was then looking at the law to see, because I was like, you know, okay, so it, you know, you're allowed to randomly allocate and use this particular method, and then it says it needs to be administered by somebody who's independent, which immediately made me kind of go, okay, well, who are the people that were doing it then? So I then asked the Freedom of Information request of the secondary school that had been using this random allocation, and I had to chase that school in order to get the names of those people out of them. And it turns out that actually one of the people that was doing it was a guy called Hugh Monroe. Now, Hugh Monroe was the head teacher when the cathedral was private, and he was one of the people that wrote the original expression of interests to turn it into an academy to get state funding. And another person that was apparently an independent person that allocated the places was a guy that was part of the steering group that set up the primary school, advising the school about admissions policies.
Now, I mentioned this Durand Academy in Southwell in South London. I mean, this chap, this headmaster I mentioned just now, he's basically using the school as his own kind of private property to use various buildings for his own businesses and that kind of thing. Have we got any examples of that here in Bristol?
Not that I have come across, but that's not to say that those examples aren't there.
Okay, well, folks, if anyone knows anything...
anybody has any ideas about where the contracts are going for maintenance, construction, you know, who owns the firms that are kind of, you know, maintaining and running these schools, it'd be really interesting to know.
I wonder if they're also going to merchant venture firms, who knows?
Wouldn't that be interesting? Who does the accounts? Who does all the, you know, all the legal letters when John Laycock has to go to court?
There was one issue, wasn't there, with Merchants Academy down south of the city about trying to install a rifle range, I believe, in one of these schools when it was first being constructed. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't. I first heard that from you.
Oh, really? Okay.
I didn't know they were trying to get a rifle range down there.
Yeah, pretty amazing stuff. Anyway, look, one of the side aspects of this is the sort of blurring of the lines between government and business. And one of the ways that that's happened is through these so-called partnerships. And we've got lots of those now. Merchant venturers on the local enterprise partnership. And we're going to be looking at that in a minute. After Christine, you've been through some of the individual characters and merchant venturers on various running various schools in the city.
Yeah, so that, I mean, currently there are 9 schools in the city that are either run or sponsored by the merchant venturers as an organisation, or have merchant venturers heavily involved in the governance and the running of it. There's a 10th that's about to be open down on the old Fairfield, the old Montpellier site where Fairfield used to be. So there's going to be another primary school that's opening there. And, you know, Colston Girls, if we look at who the chair of governors is for Colston Girls, and their feeder primary school, the Dolphin, a guy called Trevor Smallwood. So he's a merchant venturer. Interestingly,
Jackie Cornish.
She is, her name appears there. A guy called Andrew Yates, he's also a merchant venturer. Chris Patterson is a merchant venturer. So, you know, these names are around. And a guy called Andrew Yates as well. So they're all involved in the Colston Girls Trust. Of course, the big merchant venturer for all the cathedral schools is Stephen Parsons. And Stephen Parsons, when you look at the website for these schools, you know, he actually went to the school. He's been involved in the school apparently for, you know, a few decades. And he's on the trustee. He's like one of the sponsors for these schools. He's the chair of the secondary school and he's now the chair of the primary school. And of course, the Church of England is very heavily involved with those two schools as well. So that's maybe another sideline issue we can do another time, their involvement with the church.
Well, I will mention our little excursion into the Charter Day service at the cathedral, because that was quite interesting to see the bishop there basically saying, well, the merchants have almost written my sermon for me. They've booked the cathedral. And he was certainly implying that the people who had instructed him that the Edward Colston's involvement, business dealings and the criticism through the slave trade was speculation, were the merchants who'd hired the cathedral. And I remember when I came out of the cathedral, I was quite amazed and surprised to see a whole massive queue of people. I mean, actually, it was a private booking for the cathedral and public money being used to bus school children in there who had no choice about whether to be there or not. So that's a whole other side
well,
to
you,
this.
Well, you know, Tony, who the canon treasurer is for Bristol Cathedral? John Savage of University Hospitals Bristol.
Crikey, I think we need it almost like a kind of a map of people.
Absolutely.
Who
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we can
map
work on
of
that
merchants.
But anyway.
And the Right Reverend David Hoyle, I think his name is of course, he's the Dean of Bristol Cathedral. So he is the person that ultimately is responsible for the bookings, if you like, that gets into the cathedral. But he is also appears as a member of the governing body on both the cathedral's secondary and the primary school.
But he's hardly likely to say, hang on, this merchant booking out of the cathedral isn't appropriate, is he?
Well,
I very much doubt it.
That's a question certainly for the diocese to be considering. So merchant academies, we've got a guy called Ross Ansell. So he's a merchant academy. He appears at the top. So I presume that he's the chair, although it didn't say.
This is a guy called Dennis Wise. Okay, this is just to be clear, this is down in Withywood, isn't it?
Yes, this is the merchants. So it used to be a guy called Dennis Wise, who is also heavily involved in kind of youth and community stuff down in the south. One of the, you know, he's quite heavily involved in that. A guy called Patrick Despard, he's also on the governing body of the Merchants Academy. Nick Hood, Laura Marshall, Peter McCarthy, Tony Kenny, and Chris Curling is also on the governing body. And then we got the One World Trust. Now, the One World Trust was their first kind of venture in 2003 into academisation. It was the first academy in Bristol, it was part of the first wave. And it was individual merchant venturers that were getting involved. It was John Laycock then, and it's John Laycock now. But I actually looked today at all the lists of people that are involved in the One World Trust, which includes the City Academy and Bannerman Road Primary. And it's only John Laycock who is kind of the lone merchant venturer voice that is involved in the One World Trust. So I think that'll be it'd be interesting to see whether, you know, how much longer John Laycock chooses to remain involved in that One World Trust.
Another bit of news about academies in The Guardian, they seem to really keep track of them quite well actually, is that academy schools have been stockpiling £2.5 billion of education funding. So they're taking the money, but they're not necessarily spending it on the kids. I'm not quite sure where they're investing that or where it's going. But anyway, let's have a look now at... Have you finished your list, Christine?
Yes.
Okay, let's have a look now at this whole business of partnerships, which have come in over the last 10, 20 years or so, where business is involved with government in managing how public money is spent. And we're going back to good old James Garrett's documentary from 1995, part of West Eye View on HTV.
4 years after its formation, the Bristol Development Corporation is well on the way to transform...
Over the past decade, local authorities have lost much of their power and money to unelected boards or quangos. The principal quangos locally, like the Bristol Development Corporation, are headed by merchant venturers. BDC chairman Christopher Thomas is one of three merchants on the board. The Avon Training and Enterprise Council, annual budget £30 million, is headed by the newest merchant, Colin Green, head of Rolls-Royce at Patchway. The board of the United Bristol Healthcare Trust, which runs 9 hospitals, including the Royal Infirmary, is headed by venturer Bob McKinley. Another merchant on the board is Louis Sherwood, also chairman of HTV and the Bristol Chamber of Commerce and Initiative, based at Lee Court. It's involved in regular consultation with the City Council over the future development of Bristol.
The City Council is very concerned about the growth of quangos and the way that democratic accountability is being lost to non-elected, appointed boards. And one hears that a lot of members of these boards are merchant venturers, and one can only speculate on the reasons why they're appointed.
We're not attempting to involve ourselves in politics. We are very careful to avoid politics. Our desire is to be involved with the City of Bristol and to be involved with the various aspects of life that we think with which we should be involved.
Well, that's pretty vague, but and also saying he's not interested in getting involved in politics. Well, I'm not so sure about that either. Now, we've seen since then, I mean, that's 20 years ago, that amazingly enough, that documentary was broadcast on HTV. But we've seen the whole business of these partnerships moving forwards and forward. With one of the most important in the area is the Local Enterprise Partnership. That is chaired by James Jury, who is also a merchant venturer. What these partnerships do is they have various people sitting around the table spending public money, and less of the influence of how that public money is spent is democratically elected councillors being around that table. More and more of it seems to be business people. Anyway, Daphne, let's also have a look at the West of England, I think, what is it?
It's the Academic Health Partnership or Health Science Network.
Okay, so what do they do?
Well, this is something that NHS England set up a year or two ago, and they're all around the country. So there's one in the Southwest Peninsula. We've got one here which covers the old Bristol, North Somerset, South Gloucestershire primary care trust area, and I think it maybe goes up to Gloucestershire as well. And it's all about academia and the NHS and possibly the council getting involved to try and promote research into health matters here. And this organisation here, the West of England Academic Health Science Network, I think it's either chaired by Professor Steve West, who's the Vice Chancellor of UWE, or he's on the board. I think he chairs it. And their objective on their website is innovation at the heart of health and care to improve outcomes and contribute to wealth creation. So when I read that, I thought, wealth creation for whom? And also Steve West is involved in the Bristol Health Partnership, which seems to be another quango. So this is all part of this map of all these organisations and where the merchants are embedded in them and how much influence they hold and to what extent they open themselves to public scrutiny and accountability, especially when, as in the case of this West of England Academic Health Science Network, there is public money involved.
Well, there's a fantastic amount of public money involved, isn't there? Of course, with the two trusts spending about £1 billion of our money a year, the two NHS trusts. Back to education, though, and another Guardian article is criticising actually the Department for Education. The spending watchdog, National Audit Office, has been saying to the Department for Education, you have no idea what money is owed by whom to whom when it comes to academy schools. I suppose I better read the article out, actually, rather than just kind of paraphrase it. It says, the government's multi-billion pound academies programme, in which thousands of schools have been taken out of local authority control and directly managed from Whitehall, has thrown the Department for Education's finances into disarray. In an extremely rare move, the National Audit Office Public Spending Watchdog issued an adverse opinion on the department's financial statements, indicating it does not trust the accuracy of DfE's figures and is unable to assess whether it is providing any value for money. So this actually is far worse than it was before, Christine.
Yeah, I saw this. And this has been, I mean, there's been warnings about this for years and years and years. There is absolutely no way that civil servants sat in a desk in an office in London is going to be able to manage thousands of different academies up and down the country, you need local oversight in order to make sure that what these academies are doing are actually serving those children that need to use the state education sector. Because the local authority has the legal responsibility to make sure that every child in the area has access to state education, yet they themselves are not have no real authority and control over the people or the organisations that are running the schools. And that is this is a real issue in Bristol, because no secondary mainstream schools in Bristol are now controlled by the local authority, and what we're seeing is this massive breakup. And the local the offices in the local authority really have very little idea about what is actually going on in the on the ground, and the head teachers themselves are accountable to their governors and they're accountable to the sponsors, whereas when they're under the local authority they would have been accountable to local authority officers and therefore the elected councillors. And I would really like to see officials, locally elected councillors, really begin to understand this, because we're losing control of how our secondary, particularly our secondary state sector, actually is operating.
And one wonders whether, you know, academies are going to start going in the direction of this one from South London, with heads running them like private fiefdoms. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers: it's not really so much that the lines are being blurred between public and private here. It's almost like actually there is no very, very little public accountability left.
Well, there's lots of public money involved. That's the point, isn't it? I mean, when the merchant venturers were dealing with private schools, as they were in the past, in a way, that's the privilege of the privileged, and it's nothing, not a lot anybody can do about it. But once you start bringing the private sector into the public sector, and partnership sounds like such a kind of reasonable idea, doesn't it? But the problem is that public money cannot be committed to private uses, especially when there's confidentiality and lack of transparency. And when I was involved, I worked for the council in the social enterprise department, and one of the real problems they have this idea of setting up social enterprises, but the fact is that if you've got public money involved, you can't have private money involved as well, and secrecy involved. The legal side of the council were saying all these ideas of social enterprises are not really legally viable, because actually public money cannot just be allocated to private uses. But of course that line has been very, very severely blurred. And of course the other problem is that you then end up spending a hell of a lot more than you intended and not getting the outcomes that you expected.
Okay, let's sum up. Daphne, where can listeners follow your work and find your stuff on the internet, etc.?
If you just go on an internet search engine and put in Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group, you'll find us.
Okay, lovely. And Christine?
I'm best found on a search engine by my name with Twitter, I would suggest.
Okay, and we'll be hearing more about this, I think, in the future, especially since we've set ourselves on a little mission now to do a little map to find out which merchants are aware.
A big map, I think,
actually,
Tony.
Maybe it might be, yeah. And we'll have to see if we can get that online for you. Anyway, that's it for this week. Time to sign off. Time for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. We'll be bringing you the Diana story next week. Our sister show, Dialects, on Monday at 11 a.m, where we hear about the top Bristol Spanish blog. And we hear about teaching in prison. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. That was Councillor for Henbury and leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Mark Weston. I'm Tony Gosling. You can follow this show online at thisweek.org.uk or follow me on Twitter or at Tony Gosling. See you next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, young Muslims have accused Boris Johnson of being narrow-minded. The Mayor of London claims Britons who leave to join Islamic State extremists are tortured men who've been rejected by women. He says they feel like losers who typically will look at porn. These Muslim men in Leeds are angered by the remarks.
Boris Johnson could turn around and say he might be misguided. That would be a lot better instead of just turning around and saying you're a loser.
It's massive out there. You need to come out there and discuss with young people what are the issues.
You can't specifically say it must be because of this or it must be because of that. The knowledge is very narrow-minded.
Police investigating the disappearance of a mother of four in Dorset have found a body in a lake. 25-year-old Samantha Henderson's partner has been charged with her murder. Four Polish burglars who beat up a university lecturer have been jailed for up to 19 years each. Paul Kohler says he was left utterly unrecognisable by the attack at his home in southwest London last August. An alleged road rage incident involving former Manchester United captain Roy Keane is under investigation. Police were called to Altrincham town centre this morning following a row with a taxi driver. Mitt Romney has ruled himself out of running for the White House. The Republican has tried to become US president twice before, but now says it's time for the next generation of party leaders to stand. And two pilots have broken the world distance record for a flight in a helium balloon. The pair, an American and a Russian, accomplished the feat by crossing the Pacific Ocean, the first people to do so in 34 years. They've also set a longest time record, over 138 hours and counting. David Hempelman-Adams has previously crossed the Atlantic in an open wicker basket hot air balloon.
It's down to the weather. That can change, as we all know. It's a big old ocean, and if they've got to ditch in the ocean or...